It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Tuesday, child care providers and advocates from around Wisconsin gathered on the steps of the state capitol to rally for state funding.
The event kicked off with Madison's Raging Grannies singing what they called the Affordable Child Care Chant. Here's some of that protest song, courtesy of Wisconsin Eye.
Quality child care, affordable child care is what we need, is what we need. And decent pay for teachers, decent pay for teachers. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
All right.
Child care centers around the state closed their doors on Monday as part of a national day without child care, and some are still closed as child care leaders continue to protest at the Capitol.
This comes on the heels of the Republican-led Joint Finance Committee removing hundreds of items from Governor Evers' budget proposal, including a continuation of pandemic-era child care counts funding.
Joining us now is Brooke Legler, who runs the Growing Tree Child Care Center in New Glarus. She's co-founder of the group Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed. Brooke, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
You shut down operations at the Growing Tree this week as part of the state capitol protest and advocacy. What effect is that having on your families?
It's having a significant effect, not only the inconvenience of not having childcare and trying to hustle around and still work this week and find alternative care, but also the impending of not knowing what's going to happen. My parents are aware of the cuts. We do a lot of advocacy together, and they know that without the funding, tuition rates will increase, and they also are aware that we already have rooms that sit empty, so increasing the tuition doesn't necessarily mean I'll still be able to stay open, because we don't know if the community has enough essentially wealthy people to take on supporting the entire center.
So you have 54 children now. You have room for 100. Why are these rooms dark? Why do you have so many open spots?
The rooms are empty because of the lack of teachers. The lack of teachers is because of the low wages. The low wages are because we can't actually charge parents what the true cost of care is. We can only charge what our community can afford. And that equates to the low wages. So the average wages in Wisconsin right now is $13. Prior to the pandemic, the ARPA funds, it was $10.66 an hour. So that's with the lack of the funds, with them ending and it being cut in the budget, we're essentially asking to remain at $13 an hour is what we're asking for. And that is still not enough to make a living wage to support yourself, let alone a family on that.
So child care center leaders are converging on Madison this week, bringing their message of what you're just talking about. What are your demands of the legislature at this point?
Well, last week they completely removed it from the budget, and there was
the governor's budget.
Yes, the governor's proposed budget, sorry. And there was not a conversation prior to this. There is not a plan in place. It's very irresponsible legislation to remove that when that is the only thing our state would be providing. Child care is not a line item on the state budget. So for that to happen, it's a lot of uncertainty now because, again, are we going to cut the teachers' wages back down to $10 or increase the cost? So we are requesting that the legislation put that back into the budget because, again, we can't operate like that. And I think if it were any other like business field, they would have been more respectful and not just cut it without a conversation. The problem also is that we don't have lobbyists. We don't have money. We can barely get them to meet with us. And for them to essentially say like they're going back to base, early child care doesn't have a base. We don't have a foundation to work from. They cut everything from us.
We're talking about the funding of child care centers here in Wisconsin. Some centers closed their doors on Monday as part of a national day without child care, and centers continue to advocate at the state capitol for funding in the new state budget to stay afloat. Brooke Legler is here, runs the Growing Tree Child Care Center in New Glarus, and co-founded a group called Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed. this money, this $480 million that was in Governor Evers' proposal to keep the Child Care Counts program funded for the next 2 years, if that subsidy doesn't make it into the state budget for child care centers, what does that mean for your center in New Glarus?
It's uncertain. The tuition, I can try to increase the tuition, but it's already expensive. You know, a lot of families are paying, you know, upwards of 40% of their household income just on childcare. They're making decisions of whether they can afford groceries or go to the doctor or pay childcare, or even if they can work, if it's more feasible for a parent to stay home. And that's kind of why we're seeing a lack of workforce. So I will most likely try to raise the rates and see how many children, how many families can afford that. And if there's not enough, we would have to close. And there, if this doesn't get done, there will be a lot of closures come September.
The leaders of the Joint Finance Committee have said that parents are the ones who should be seeing this taxpayer money and making decisions for their own family accordingly. How do you respond to that?
Well, the thing is that the child care crisis has been an issue for many years. It was a crisis even before the pandemic. Over the last decade, there's been a 30% decrease in providers across the state, and that's a lot of business closures. So I understand where they might be coming from, wanting parents to, but they also haven't created any system then to help those parents. Last year, the only thing we saw coming from those same legislators is a tax credit, which equated for the average $650 a year. And that for some families with two children, that doesn't even pay a week. So that clearly is not going to do anything. And the other legislation they had proposed was deregulation, and that would be allowing more children per teacher. So those same teachers that are making $13 an hour basically give them more work. That's not going to do anything. That's a faster way to lose teachers. And lowering the age of teachers, and that lowers quality. We've already seen other states that have tried deregulating, and what it's actually done is increased our insurance for many of us. My insurance went up 20% this year because we know when we deregulate that we are we're removing the safety guardrails for a lot, and it's a higher liability. So our insurance is already going up. And that was something that the Republican body proposed for Wisconsin to do, and it did not pass. We fought hard to prevent that from happening.
What are your meetings like with lawmakers now, who you have been able to talk with? Are they listening, or what are those discussions like? What are those exchanges like?
It's very difficult. My senator representative is Senator Markline, who is the co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, and he will not come to my program. He will not meet one-on-one with me. I've been to his office many of times trying to set up. We are there all week. We're trying to get him to stop by, you know, walk 2 minutes down to where we are set up at the Capitol, and it is not happening. On Monday, Senator Markline proposed legislation that would encourage businesses to pay for slots or provide childcare. And I don't know about you, but, you know, WPR probably doesn't want a childcare business within the radio station. It's not feasible or doable. And I don't see how businesses could even pay for spots and decide, well, this employee, we're going to spend $15,000 a year to buy a spot. So that legislation is very disingenuous. And I think it's actually just a game to say, like, oh, I do support childcare. I propose this bill. It didn't pass, because that is a lot of the rhetoric that we hear when my parents are calling Senator Markline or the other co-chair, Representative Bourne. They are being told that both of them do support child care. Bourne is telling constituents that Wisconsin legislation puts $1 billion in child care, and that is absolutely false. So for him to make those comments along with Markline, I question whether or not they understand the budget. And if they don't, that's a problem where they probably shouldn't be in that position, or they are definitely misleading their constituents. And that's also a problem. So I'm not sure which they want to be, like not knowing how to do their job or lying to their constituents, basically, because what they're saying is absolutely false. And I really would like that to stop, because it affects our voting systems when we don't have accurate information.
The $480 million aside, what legislation would work? What else would you like to see state lawmakers do in this moment that legislatively?
Right. Well, we don't have to create our own thing. We can look at what some other states have been doing, and some have been very successful. For example, Vermont has done a payroll tax of 0.5%, and the businesses in Vermont are overwhelmingly very happy with it, because they are finally, they are getting a workforce. They passed it in April, implemented it in July, and since then, Vermont has increased 1,000 child care spots, and that's significant, especially considering the size of Vermont compared to Wisconsin.
So this is a business payroll tax?
Yes, it's a business payroll tax, which is much more of an equitable system, because it's everybody. It's nonprofit, it's profit. You pay a payroll tax, and that is increasing their workforce, increasing the spots, and the funding is going to help the wages in Vermont. And so it's working. They've increased the wages, which increases, when you increase the wages of the teachers, you affect the quality and the accessibility. And they're doing that exactly, and it is successful for them. And so it's not like we have to create a whole new thing. Like a lot of legislators, they'll propose something, and they'll even say, like, I know this isn't the silver bullet for this, the magic bullet. And to me, that shouldn't be okay to say like that. That's your job, is mm-hmm. to come up with plans. Don't propose something if it's not going to work, especially when we do have examples of legislation that does work.
Brooke, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the awareness that you're bringing to the situation.
Brooke Legler is operator of the Growing Tree Child Care Center in New Glarus, co-founder of Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed. She's been at the state capitol this week advocating for funding for child care centers around Wisconsin and to be included in the next state budget.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, researchers are gathering in Madison to talk about their work in an emerging field, social genomics.
We've really tried to combine nature and nurture and think about the interplay of those two forces in producing health inequalities, and many other social outcomes.
That's ahead here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This week, WPR reporters are diving into the development of data centers around Wisconsin and the impacts they could have on the communities where they are being built and the state as a whole. Construction of a Microsoft data center project is underway in Mount Pleasant.
Evan Casey visited West Des Moines to see how 5 Microsoft data center campuses have impacted that community.
David Roach has lived on his family's 40-acre farm in Iowa for most of his life.
My dad was born in that house up there. My grandfather died right, you know, over where the pine trees are. The sun sets right over that pond, so every night you have like a painting when you look out the window, and it's just, it's kind of sad.
A few years ago, a massive data center complex went up around 2 miles from his home.
I'm used to being out here in the middle of nowhere, you can see the stars, you can see the moon. Well, now it's a glow coming from the east over here, like a small city.
Roach lives right outside of West Des Moines, a city of around 73,000 in central Iowa. Microsoft first announced plans to build a data center campus there back in 2008. In 2012, the tech giant opened that complex. They now operate 5 campuses in the city and own over 600 acres. Microsoft has pointed to the centers in West Des Moines as the epicenter behind its AI technology. Russ Trimble is a Wisconsin native and the mayor of West Des Moines.
And we knew that it was going to be a huge game changer for our community, and it absolutely has been.
He says Microsoft has invested around $5 billion in its facilities so far. They've also invested in over 130 projects in the greater Des Moines area since 2017, including a community amphitheater next to West Des Moines City Hall. and that has made West Des Moines third in the state for property valuation, even though they have the seventh largest population.
They have supported a number of nonprofits around not only the city of West Des Moines, but the Des Moines metro area.
There wasn't a lot to see or hear outside the data centers. The sprawling complexes look like three or four warehouses from the outside. Inside, there are row after row of computer servers. It's pretty quiet next to the facilities, except for when construction trucks are coming in and out. Margaret Van Ginkel and her husband live next door to one, but it wasn't by choice.
I mean, just truckload after truckload of cement go by here.
She says Microsoft has been a good neighbor for the most part and helped pave a road next to their home, but they've had to put up with noisy construction for the past 9 years.
So it's good and bad, but you do lose the country feel. You know, I don't have that country feel. And at night, it looks like a big city out here.
Microsoft says over 600 employees work at the centers in West Des Moines. Ryan Moffitt is the city's community and economic development director.
They're probably number 7 or 8 in terms of largest full-time employers.
But they're the biggest water user in the city. Last year, Microsoft guzzled up nearly 70 million gallons of water in West Des Moines. That's up from 41 million gallons in 2023. Christina Murphy is the general manager of West Des Moines Water Works. The water utility has an agreement with Microsoft that allows the company to use up to 5 million gallons of water a day. Murphy says they don't use anywhere near that now, but that could change.
Those buildings, those other data centers are still growing and still being filled out. So I anticipate they will use more water in the future.
Data centers in Iowa also consumed about 11% of the state's electricity in 2023, according to a Yahoo report. Trimble, the mayor, knows that could limit data center growth.
You're going to push the envelope on that, and you're not going to be able to develop more data centers until the energy infrastructure catches up with it.
Moffitt says the data centers are mostly located on former farmlands on the outskirts of town.
And so what we'll do is create a TIF district and use the increment that comes off the data centers to help pay for our infrastructure that goes in to serve the data centers.
But Microsoft has said it is slowing or pausing construction at some sites. Moffitt says over 10% of the city's tax base is now tied to the centers.
You know, we want to be mindful of ensuring that we can diversify our economy. If for whatever reason you don't need the same size of facility, or these did go dark and the assessments plummeted, that would be impactful to us.
A sixth data center is slated to start construction in West Des Moines sometime next year. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
The emerging scientific field called social genomics aims to put an end to the nature versus nurture debate, instead arguing the two coexist and influence each other through a person's lifetime.
Put it another way, our genes by themselves aren't enough to explain the course of our lives and what happens. Our environment also plays a part.
Researchers from around the world are meeting at UW-Madison this week to talk about advancements in the field of social genomics and some of the ethical issues in genetic predictions.
We've gathered a roundtable of UW-Madison professors and the La Follette School of Public Affairs to explain their work in social genomics and how it affects society. Sylvia Elena Barcelos, Lauren Schmitz, and Jason Fletcher join us now. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Kate.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Lauren, when I think about this field, I'm kind of blown away by how it blends so many different disciplines. You've got the health sciences, the psychology, the biostatistics, the human genome. What are the challenges for researchers in collaborating with scientists from such different backgrounds and figuring out what to study and why?
That's such a great question, Kate, and it is a challenge. I think when we're bringing together social data with molecular data, we really have to do team science. So and what's been partially so great about this initiative is that we've been able to bring together biostatisticians, health economists, psychologists, sociologists, et cetera, to really bring our knowledge together and our expertise together to talk about the best way to model these interactions and how they affect health. And a big thing that has allowed us to do that is it has become cheaper and cheaper in some of these larger population health studies that are kind of our bread and butter as health economists, to start to collect genomic data on individuals, as well as other molecular data that can help us really understand what's going on inside the cell and how that might be interacting with social forces.
What is your contribution in this space? What do you bring to it?
Yeah, so I've been fascinated by gene-environment interaction. I've done some work in that area. And then more and more, I'm doing work with epigenetics. In that discipline, there's been some really interesting biomarkers of aging, of biological aging, that have come out. So these are able to tell us, we can take a blood test from somebody and we can tell them what their biological age is. And then we can see whether they're aging faster or slower than their chronological age, which is something that has long been a quest in the field of gerontology. If we can identify who's aging faster than their chronological age, we can also link that to other factors across their life course that might be contributing to that, which then, of course, helps with interventions at the policy level and at the clinical level. So I've been doing a lot of work linking these biological factors of aging with social experiences across the life course.
And Sylvia, when you look at this field, it was called emerging 10 years ago. How do you view it as to where social genomics is going and what your contribution is to it?
Sure. Hi, Kate. It's a very exciting field right now. Just the explosion of data that Lauren referred to. It's been just 10 years ago that, you know, you mentioned you kind of started, but we've learned so much, in part because we didn't have the data and the tools before we had, you know, decoded the human DNA to do that kind of research. So it's really like this links of data, the wealth of data we have now. Data in some European countries where we have genetic data linked to health registries, to tax registries, to longitudinal data on people's economic and health lives. And it's just a very exciting time to the field because this explosion of data, explosion of methods really allows us to do so much and to learn so much about these intersections across these disciplines. In terms of my contribution to the field, I'm also a health economist, so I'm interested in determinants of health and SES and how these interact. And I'm really excited right now into kind of bringing my training as an economist in causal methods and linking that to the genetic data and the, you know, links with administrative data and really understand how genetics and, you know, interacted with the environment shapes people's lives. So I think that's the most exciting thing for me.
But with big data and using, you know, huge amounts of data and computing power to uncover, you know, genetic contributions to social traits, there's also this fear, right, that policies could be shaped about how you are, like your life insurance policy and your risk for having a heart attack. You could pay higher premiums. How do you look at the field in those respects with privacy?
So I can try to answer that. I think it's a very, very interesting question you're posing and one that is already happening, right? I think the data is out there. People are taking more and more this direct-to-consumer tests. And it is important to kind of think about how policy and regulation should react to ensure that, you know, insurance markets, as you mentioned, are working, you know, are working properly with this data. You know, it's not only, you know, it's not only the case of privacy and the worry about the dangers to consumers, but also the dangers to the insurance markets as a whole. So there are a lot of different lenses that needs to be studied, and with important policy and regulation implications that is part of the work we are interested in doing.
What do you make of it, Jason? Will biologically informed policies become more acceptable, more mainstream in the future?
You're right in describing how controversial this question is. And U.S. has some protections, as you know, around health insurers not discriminating against individuals' genetics and employers not discriminating against people based on their genetics. But those laws could be expanded. And that's something that our group really thinks about, both the pros and the cons. And other countries are considering more stringent standards about in what cases individuals can act on their genetic information, or other units in society can act on individuals' genetic information. But it's a very emerging field. And I think this is an example of the promise of having many disciplines examining a field like this. There would be many, many lenses to examine this question. That's an advantage of our group and other groups around the country.
We're talking about the future of social genomics with three UW-Madison professors, Jason Fletcher there. We have Sylvia Elena Barcelos and Lauren Schmitz with us. Lauren, later this month, UW-Madison hosting the Advances in Social Genomics Conference for researchers from around the world. What do you hope to gain from the conference?
Well, given that this is such a new and exciting field, I think there are not always a lot of opportunities for us to come together, the scientists that are interested in this type of work. So I think it's always a wonderful time to bring interested researchers here to Madison and to see what everyone's working on, and to discuss how we can move the field forward. So I think a lot of those interactions are just are really important. Especially because we are all coming from different policy environments, different historical background contexts in terms of, you know, what got researchers here to begin with. So it's really imperative, I think, that we come together at this point as the field's evolving to discuss our research. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
Hmm. You know, I'm wondering, Sylvia, how could bits of data become so predictive of life outcomes? And what are the risks? Can we read into that too much?
Yeah, I think there's been, for me, was they are surprisingly predictive, to be honest. Hmm. So I, when I first got into this field, I was, skeptical, like healthy, skepticism. And the more I worked with the data, the more I was amazed at how predicted it was and how it was predictive above and beyond more traditional measures we had in the social sciences. And that's where I think that really the value added comes in, because it is something different that is allowing us to move our knowledge forward. In terms of misinterpretation, I want to go back to a point that Jason made, that while it is highly predictive, I feel like we are, this genetic markers, we are still in our infancy in understanding the channels through which they operate. Clearly, when we talk about more social outcomes and even some diseases, it's, the way, the pathways in which this genetic predict disease or, say education, it's much more, it's very social, and it's kind of not only biological. And I think that's a very normal misconception that the public has, that just because it's genetic, it's biological. And what we as a field have found is that, yes, these genetic markers are predictive, but they are far from being only, they're far from working only through biological pathways. And I think understanding this and really underlying this lesson is very important for how we think about it and what kind of conclusions we can and can't take from this these very predictive markers.
Hmm. And you start to wonder then, you know, was what you experienced a random coincidence, or whether your success was something authentic to you, or was it a lucky break, or was it your DNA? Mm-hmm. And it starts, you know, Jason, to bring up so many questions about the human experience, but and also who we are inside with our genes.
You're exactly right. Everyone has those both family stories about, you know, uncles or aunts that did some a certain way or was a highly trained musician and passing that down in their families as a partial explanation for your own generations or, you know, or your own siblings' successes or failures. So it does both go along with some of the folk tales that we have in our family, but also breaks from them. I mean, very importantly, to go back to some of the things we talked about before, this is very much nature and nurture and not deterministic, as Sylvia was just describing. If there's no nature without nurture and there's no nurture without nature in these cases, and we're building data sets on each of those sides and methods from each of those sides to combine what we can learn from both and how they interact with one another. That's what's so unique. You know, you're even individuals who are identical twins experience very different environments as they grow older. And so it's both nature and the nurture that they face.
Well, Jason, Lauren, and Sylvia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you. This was great. Thank you.
That is Sylvia Elena Barcelos, Lauren Schmitz, and Jason Fletcher. They're on the faculty of the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. The conference called Advances in Social Genomics opens today at UW-Madison, showcasing the work of researchers from around the world in the fields of social science and genetic research, looking at how genes and people's environments interact.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a promising new study finds mindfulness interventions and cognitive therapies can help relieve chronic back pain.
When it's really bad, it takes them over emotionally as well as physically, and they get deeply stuck in the present moment.
New developments for managing back pain, that's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Millions of Americans suffer from chronic lower back pain. The World Health Organization says that it is the single leading cause of disability worldwide.
New research from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health shows that mindfulness interventions or cognitive therapy, also known as talk therapy, have led to lasting improvements for adults. These study participants were managing their chronic back pain with opioid medications.
Dr. Bruce Barrett is vice chair for research and a professor of family medicine and community health at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's among the authors in this recent study about chronic back pain. Dr. Barrett, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks, Kate. Very happy to be here.
Before we dive into the research, let's talk about lower back pain. How common is it for people who don't know what it feels like? Can you describe the symptoms?
This is a condition that I think almost every adult has had at some point. Usually it's transient. Pain can be very mild or moderate or severe. For others, it can become more chronic to last sometimes for many years. Quite a common condition.
In this particular study, you enrolled 770 adults in this trial conducted in Madison, Boston, and Salt Lake City. Who were these people and what were you finding from them?
So they were patients at medical facilities who had longstanding chronic back pain that was severe enough that they had to be taking an opioid medication regularly to help control it. So generally older adults and all with some level of impairment of function from their pain.
Walk us through the trial. What else were they doing to help manage this type of pain?
So that varied across the people, depending on their healthcare system, their doctor. They might be seeing a physical therapist. Some people might be seeing a mental health counselor to help them manage symptoms. Some were employed, some were unemployed. So a wide variety of life situations. All of them had a medical care, so they had, you know, had medical insurance and already were in a healthcare system.
And so can you walk us through? This sounds like a more holistic treatment approach because there's a certain type of talk therapy involved.
Yeah, the probably the most common and well-researched and substantiated type of talk therapy is called a cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. And it's just a way of helping patients work through the different ways that the pain or dysfunction might interfere with their lives and to figure out ways to best manage it. So it's a very pragmatic approach, and that's what's recommended for patients with this condition. We were testing that against the newer mindfulness-based therapy, which is mindfulness training helps people become more aware of their thoughts, emotions, bodily feelings, teaches some meditation practices. So we were really comparing the standard way of working with group therapy. Both of these arms of the trial were done with groups. And we're comparing the standard, well-validated method with a newer, hopeful method called mindfulness-based therapy.
So if mindfulness involves us becoming more aware of our present moment, not, you know, dwelling on the past or projecting into the future, how does that apply to back pain? Because someone would say, Dr. Barrett, I don't want a heightened awareness of my chronic pain right now.
That's an excellent question. How it seems to work is that by training yourself to be able to be in the present moment, noticing feelings, noticing bodily feelings, but also mental feelings and thoughts, you're able to accept them and to remind yourself that you're free to make your own choices, that you have had these symptoms before, that last time they were this bad, you were able to get through it. We don't train people to focus on their pain and to feel it more. Instead, we train people to be more aware of and therefore have more control over how they respond to the present moment.
How can we learn to listen to our bodies and perhaps pace ourselves or pull back when there are signs that the pain might become unmanageable? Are we just not listening closely enough to some of the signs?
Well, what we've found and what other groups around the world really have found is that it requires practice. So there are a number of fairly standard meditative practices. One of them is called body scan, where you will find yourself in a lying down or sitting position and then progressively notice sensations throughout the whole body, like starting at the toes and going up the legs. You can spend 5 minutes, 30 seconds, or 45 minutes doing a body scan. You can also do breath meditation, where you focus the awareness on the inhalation, the exhalation, the expansion of the rib cage, the contraction, how you might feel it in your mouth, nose, or throat. By practicing focusing of awareness, over time, you can develop more control over how you react, and you can become more aware of when things happen, and that you don't need to react habitually, but you can actually make decisions about how to react to things that are coming at you, such as pain.
What might those decisions entail? What might be your choices in that moment?
First, remind yourself that you've had it before and you're getting through it. Second, notice if there is something that you can do to relieve it now, to not be taken over by the pain, but instead to make a choice such as lying down or stretching or just taking a breath. What a lot of patients with severe chronic pain have found is that when it's really bad, it takes them over emotionally as well as physically, and they get deeply stuck in the present moment. With mindfulness training, you can learn to become unstuck. The pain doesn't go away, but it doesn't bother you as much.
Were these mindfulness sessions done at their own homes, on their own time? How did that work in the study?
Interestingly, the study started before the pandemic, and all of the group sessions were in person with either with a cognitive behavioral therapist in the one group or with a mindfulness-based trained therapist in the other group. So they were in person halfway through. Then along came the pandemic, and we transitioned to virtual meetings for both groups. In which people would be doing it at home. In addition to the two-hour session once a week for 8 weeks, in group session, people were asked to do the practices at home outside of the group. And that was true for both the CBT, the standard therapy group, and the mindfulness group.
Does the outcome of this particular trial change the way physicians like you might prescribe to patients or help to manage the pain?
I think it should. What our main findings were is that people in both groups got dramatically better. They had lower pain scores. They had lower disability scores or interference with daily activity scores, and they used less opioid medications. That was true in both groups, and it was both statistically significant and clinically significant. The amount of benefit was real and appreciable in both groups. What we didn't find is that one was better than the other. By comparing statistically the groups to each other, both groups got much better. What this does in medical practice is allow another option. So the CBT standard therapy option was already there and was already evidence-based. Now we can say that the mindfulness training is just as good as the standard training, and therefore, in my opinion, should be made available to patients as a choice.
But how do you prescribe mindfulness?
That depends where you are. Here in Madison, Wisconsin, we have a fairly large mindfulness opportunity, a set of mindfulness opportunities. We have a sangha of a dozen certified mindfulness instructors that work with the UW. We have the Center for Healthy Minds that Richie Davidson started that has done much of research. We have lots of individual practitioners who do both group and in-person mindfulness training. In many other communities, maybe most communities around the country, that wouldn't be available. So I think it really depends on your location.
We're talking about one of the most common ailments in America, lower back pain. Dr. Bruce Barrett is with us, family physician and a professor in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's one of the authors of a recent study showing how mindfulness and cognitive behavioral therapy sessions can improve symptoms. Dr. Barrett, when you talk with people who have chronic back pain, these patients, how do you talk to them about their thoughts and what they think might be able to influence that physical pain and cross over between emotional processing and the actual biological symptoms here or the effects of the pain?
It depends on the patient. It's a really good question, and it's a complicated one. In my opinion, different people can benefit from different things, and the pain can come from different sources, and it might impact different parts of one's life. So in family medicine, which is what I've practiced for two or three decades, we try to First, learn from the patient what is important to them. Why do you want your health? What is this condition, in this case, chronic back pain, to you? How is it impacting you? When? Under what circumstances? Are there other factors that might be exacerbating it? Or are there factors that might help alleviate it or help give you more control? So it takes a fair amount of discussion, and it really needs to be individualized. I think both the standard cognitive behavioral therapy and the mindfulness-based therapy can be effective, are effective, but in different ways for different people. So I think it really should be individualized and made as available as possible.
people experience pain at different levels. You know, their pain threshold might be different. How does that factor into treatment when you look at the avenues of mindfulness and cognitive behavioral therapy?
Well, the severity matters a lot, and so does the duration or the chronicity, whether it's intermittent, recurrent, or whether it's the same every day. It matters a lot what's causing it. You know, if what's causing it is a job where you're lifting 50-pound bales all the time, and physical therapy and CBT therapy, mindfulness therapy aren't helping, well, then maybe you need to remove the insult of overuse. In many conditions, it's underuse. People are afraid of the pain and are reluctant to do the type of physical therapy, strengthening and stretching and mobility training that can really be helpful. So, again, it depends on the individual.
And with that, what is the next step for this research? Where would you like to take it next?
We would like to see if the effects last over time. This trial followed people for a full year, which is unusual and a long time. But with somebody with a condition that could last 5, 10, or 20 years, it's not so long. So we would really like to know if it goes on, if the effects go on longer. I would like to know if booster sessions can be helpful. Meeting once every 6 months in group to check in with practices, for instance. How about combining things to two different types of therapies together, give more than one alone? There are numerous research questions awaiting our future.
Aside from this research and this study, how can people in general preserve their back to prevent future back pain and keep it healthy?
Strengthening and flexibility. So yoga, for instance, there are many kinds of yoga and many different types of positions and exercises, but some of them are really good at engaging the core muscles, both the external core muscles that you can feel with your fingers, the abdomen and the back muscles, and then also the deeper muscles, the iliopsoas muscles that go along the spine. So different types of exercises that you can learn from a physical therapist can allow you to strengthen those muscles so that when you do get an insult to your back, it doesn't throw your back out. Most of us spend too much time sitting in chairs and not enough time with physical activity. We don't have strong enough core muscles. Flexibility also, stretching is crucial, I think, to maintaining a healthy back.
Dr. Barrett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Bruce Barrett is Vice Chair for Research and a Professor of Family Medicine and Community Health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Author on a recent study about interventions for chronic lower back pain, it was published in the journal JAMA Network Open.
Gardeners are busy getting their hands in the soil and putting in those spring plantings. On a future program, we're going to talk about a crop that grows without the soil.
Lettuce is an extremely fast-growing hydroponic crop, and a school on the Wisconsin border is growing it to stock their lunchroom salad bar.
We'll hear from a student who's leading this effort and the Green Bay company that sells the hydroponic units to help schools get started in growing their own greens.
What do you grow without soil? What questions do you have about hydroponics that we can include in this segment? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can get in touch by voicemail and text at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232 to talk about hydroponics.
Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Royce Podeswa, and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.